So it's really good to be back in Canada. I mean that. It's really, really nice to be back in Canada. There's cultural politeness in Canada that you don't experience in the rest of the world. That's really refreshing. Even though some people say it's fake, I like it. So, yeah, it's really good to be back. If you don't know, TJ mentioned that I wasn't, well, he sort of said that I was in Israel. He also said that I was from Israel, which I'm not. I just spent 3 weeks in Israel. I was living in Jerusalem and taking a law course there. Maybe all of you know that, but just in case someone doesn't. It was intro to legal systems. Sorry, intro to Israeli legal systems specifically. A lot of people ask me, why would you take that course, or why does Manitoba's law school offer that course? Because it's Israeli, and that seems really unique or out there. And one of the things our prof said to us about Israel is that typically Israel has almost every conflict that the rest of the world does, but it's just more complicated in Israel. So every conflict that Canada has, Israel has too, but it's just way more complicated in Israel. So they think it's just a great time to go out and learn about Israel and how they're trying to deal with their conflicts, and then reflect back on Canada or the rest of the world or anywhere, and how we deal with our conflicts or anyone else deals with their conflicts. So that's why I took that course, and that's also why I'm going to talk about Israel today, partially because I was just there and I'm still jet lagged, and that's really all I have on my mind to share. But also because I do think, like, learning about Israel made that really true to me, that you can really see conflicts of the whole world in a new light through the perspective of Israel, which is both good and bad. I'm sure you can imagine Israel legal systems is a very heavy course, mostly because it's packed into 3 weeks. You're supposed to learn about the whole legal system that's happening in Israel based on all the issues that are going on in Israel. It's a country surrounded by Arab states that don't exactly love Israel right now or since the state began. There's been a bunch of wars in the last 50 years. And this doesn't even begin to touch on the unique circumstances to the behind the creation of Israel as a state, and the effect that those unique circumstances have had on the legal system in Israel, as well as the creation of the country, who's there, who's not there, what's going on there, all those kinds of things. So it's a really full course. I'm not going to try to pack a packed 3-week course into one night. So I'm just going to talk about a few things. But I did realize as I was preparing today, and I talked to Tim about this, there's too much stuff that I wanted to talk about to fit into tonight. So tonight's talk actually has sort of shifted into a series. So tonight's going to be mostly an introduction. So if you're not planning to come hear me speak the next time, then it isn't going to offer you any kind of resolution whatsoever. And I'm sorry for that, but you can listen to the podcast, or you can change your mind to decide to come next time I speak, or you can take the third option and learn from today's introduction that you want nothing to do with this topic ever again. And, of course, there's freedom to choose that as well. But next time I speak, I'm just going to say this now, if you like the topic or you know people who'd want to come and discuss the topic or hear about it, it's going to feel like starting kind of fresh again. They won't have missed anything key. Like, I'll do a quick summary to start off. So just so you know, they could come next time and it would be fine. So the series, I tried to figure out what exactly to call it, but I think the bigger picture is peace. It's a series on peace. And I wanted to start with a bit of history surrounding the territory that's now called Israel. If you're not really into a lecture on history, then I will remove the fear from that and say I'm not a historian at all. It's really brief and probably super oversimplified. It's just like a brief, like, this is what's happened in the territory. I think it's really important to understand the history. That's what we had to learn when we got there. It helps you understand the conflict that's in place now, because it's so complicated and goes back so far that if you don't understand the history, then you can't even begin to talk about how this conflict can be resolved, how there can be peace in Israel. So I'm going to quickly go over the history. I have a timeline, if you want to put that up. That's Jerusalem. Anyway, he's going to put up a timeline, and I'm just going to quickly go through it, and it's like, there's going to be some gaps, there's some missing pieces. If you have a comment or a question, please do just, like, yell it out or raise your hand if you feel like that's something you have to do. But you can just yell it out. This is going to be really, really, really overly simplified, but just so that, make sure everyone's on the same page. If you already know all of this, then I think it's still helpful to have a reminder of, like, one big picture of Israel to, like, start the discussion on peace in that country. So we're starting like way back, because this is 17th century before Common Era, so this is actually in the Bible. Some of you might know it from there. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are in Israel in 17th century before... I'm sorry that my head is in there. Can I stand here? Is that okay? Okay. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are... in the land that's now called Israel. I say in Israel. It was not called, well, maybe it was called Israel at the time. It's kind of weird what the territory was called at the time. But they're in Israel, which is now Israel today. They actually leave right away because of a famine. This is the story of Joseph. You know, they go to Egypt. They can't stay in Israel anymore because there's no food there. So they go to Egypt, and they actually end up staying there all the way until the 13th century. The Israelites, that is. When Moses leads the Israelites from Egypt. This is also the time when the Torah, including the Ten Commandments, is received at Mount Sinai. And then the next two centuries, the Israelites conquer most of the land of Israel and become farmers and craftsmen instead of nomads, because they've been traveling around for 40 years in the desert. So this is the first time that there's been like a long-term establishment of Jewish people, or Israelites at the time, in that area. Then you see in, I don't know how you'd say, 1020, 1020, however you want to say it, still before Common Era. This is when the Jewish monarchy is established. So this is King Saul, King David, Solomon. These are the kings that are in that area at the time. King David defeated the Philistines, and Solomon builds the Temple of Jerusalem, which is hugely important to the conflict in Israel over the years. But I'm not going to go much into the temple at all, but just so you know, it's very important. It gets torn down and rebuilt a few times, and there's a lot of conflict between the Arab people and the Israelis over this temple. So this is when it's first built, so you can see that it goes back so far. That's why there's such importance in it. Then in 586, we have Judah conquered by Babylonia, which actually doesn't last very long. Quickly, this leads into the Arab rule. So this is 4 years after Muhammad dies in 632. At first, in the Arab rule, the Jewish settlers are allowed to start settling in the area again, so they're coming back to the area. There's a few that were left over, so Jewish people start gaining population again in the area. And the Jewish people are allowed to live under protection, that's what it's called, meaning that they're allowed to have their own religious identity and things like this, as long as they pay property taxes and a special poll and land taxes. So basically the Arabs are in charge, but the Jews are allowed to be Jewish. Then the next thing we see is Crusader domination. This is when the Christian Crusaders come in from Europe and they recover the Holy Land from the infidels, that's how it was said. So they're taking it from the Jewish people, which they believe are wrong and bad, and they're going to go back and take the Holy Land where, you know, Jesus taught and all those kinds of things. So they, in a five-week siege, they capture Jerusalem and massacre most of the city's non-Christian inhabitants. And then the Jews barricade themselves inside their synagogues and are eventually burnt to death inside the synagogues. So that's what happens then. Some of them are also sold into slavery. Then next we have the Ottoman rule. This is more relevant today. This is the Turkish Empire, and actually a lot of the Ottoman laws are still in place in Israel today. So this is a lot closer to today. 1517 to 1917, as you can see. So... yeah, I won't get into all that has to do with the legal rules and laws in Israel, but it's still in play. Then 1897, this is really important. Theodore Herzl starts Zionism. Doesn't really matter who he is, but the point is Theodore Herzl, he predicted that anti-Semitism in Europe was going to lead towards the need for a Jewish national home in the world. He didn't know where that was going to be, but he actually predicted this back in 1897. So we're talking like 60 years before the Holocaust. This guy's like, I think it's getting kind of bad in Europe. People don't like Jews. They probably need their own place. So he said that, and that actually started a movement, religion, whatever you want to call it, called Zionism. And this is the belief that the Jewish people, there's a lot of things you could say about the belief, but basically the Jewish people believe that there is a homeland, a promised land, where they're supposed to go back to. Now, if you were describing Zionism, that would mean specifically the location of Israel. At this time, people didn't know where that was going to be, but now Zionism is the idea that that either Jewish people should have a homeland, or it can go as far as believing all Jews throughout the whole world should return, and it won't be finished until every last Jew is back in Israel. So there's, like any movement, there's varying degrees of belief there. 1917, this is when Britain basically takes over the land that's now called Israel, and they find out that Israel is useless to them, the territory. They're like, there's no resources here, there's nothing. It's desert and swamp. We don't want it. So they decided, oh, well, if we don't want it, then we should give it to the Jewish people because they need a place and it's useless to us, so we'll just put them there. And they decide that what was called at this time Palestine is going to be the new national home for the Jews. And then this is confirmed in 1922 by the League of Nations. League of Nations is what later became the UN. It's not quite the same thing, but they confirmed, yes, the British should make this land into a national home for the Jewish people. And so they divided Transjordan and gave a quarter of Transjordan to the Jewish national home. Transjordan becomes a few countries later. We don't need to get into all that, one of them being Jordan. But at the time, it was like a bigger place. Like I said, oversimplified, really, really fast history. Okay, so then we get to 1939, which is the start of World War II, and the Holocaust in Europe. As you can tell, because of 1897 is when the prediction happened that anti-Semitism was going to get so strong. This was not the start of anti-Semitism. A lot of people believe that, you know, Hitler invented anti-Semitism. That's not true at all. In fact, it was huge and widespread through Europe at the time that Hitler came along. He more was like, hey, this works. Let's use this to unite my people and get them excited about something. So he just took something that was already huge and widespread and kind of jumped on it and used it as a platform. Probably most of you know this, if not all, but the Holocaust was mass killings, deportation, otherwise abuses of the Jewish people in Europe. It spread way beyond Germany and Nazi instruction. Many independent actions were based on anti-Semitism. It's a pervasive paradigm at the time. And actually, many countries throughout the world refused to have Jewish refugees come into their country. And many countries also refused to be involved or to intervene with what was going on in Europe at the time. Scholars suggest that 529, somewhere in between there, million Jewish civilians, that's really important too, civilians died in the Holocaust. Because there's a lot of numbers about who died in the Holocaust, because obviously there was a war going on, so very many people died. The difference about the Holocaust is that the 5 to 9 million people were Jewish civilians, so that number is way higher than other civilians that died in World War II. These were not people fighting in the army, these were just people that are taken from their homes. So that's a really large number in war for civilians to die. Okay, so 1947, partially, mostly in reaction to the Holocaust, the UN agrees, okay, we really need this Jewish national home, and they actually propose the establishment of a legal Jewish state, basically meaning this is going to be a country with their own laws, they're going to have their own rule, be able to practice their own religion as they see fit, and that happens in the country that at the time had been called Palestine. And they call it Resolution 181, I think. I can't see it there, but I'm pretty sure it's 181. I'll just say real quick, Resolution 181 divided the land into three sections. There was a Jewish state, a Palestinian state, and an international regime. So the Jewish state is about 53%. Palestine is about 45%. Sorry, when I say percent, I mean of all that is now considered by Israel to be Israel. I know that's a complicated statement, but I'll get there. Wow. So 45% of that land was Palestinian state, and then a little section was an international regime, and that was all of Jerusalem. So UN said Jerusalem's going to be owned by the international community. It's not going to be either Palestinian or Israeli. However, the Arabs said, absolutely not. We hate this idea. We want all of it. We don't want Israel to have any of it. And Israel actually said okay at the time, which, I mean, makes sense. They didn't really have anything to barter with. They're like, nothing or this. So they were like, yeah, this sounds good. And they agreed. However, because the Arabs didn't agree, there's now this really complicated issue where Israel feels like it was a contract between the Palestinians and the Israelis, and because the Arabs said no, no contract, right? Whereas the international community said, no, it was a contract between us and you, and it doesn't matter what the Palestinian community said, so there's still a contract. So because of those two different versions of the story, Israel says this never became a binding agreement. The international community says it does, and you're breaking it. Okay, that's something that you just have to kind of understand. Maybe you all do better than me. But anyway, either way, 1948 becomes the state of Israel. They declare independence, and they actually declare the whole area is theirs. Then there's the War of Independence, which happens because all the Arab countries are like, no way, we hate this, and they all attack. In fact, May 14th is the Declaration of Independence. May 15th is the attack of all the surrounding Arab nations. So that's a little intense. They didn't get very much celebration time. So Jordan, Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq invade real quickly on May 15th, right? That's what I said, yeah. And Israel actually wins the war, which is shocking. And they gain an additional 23% of the Palestinian land. And they actually deport the Arabs out of Israel, creating refugee camps bordering Israel, which the refugees actually believed at this time that they would come back in after the war. Never does actually happen. Then in 1949, there's peace agreements. So they have an agreement with Jordan, Egypt, Syria, and Lebanon, where maybe actually you could put up one of those in the first map. Wait, I don't even know where I told you the first map, so I'll find out when it's up there. Oh, okay. So this is just help to see. So first it's like, when the Jewish people first came there, the green is where Palestinians are occupying, and the white space is where the Jewish people are settling. So you can see, like, it's all Palestinian people and just a few little Jews. Then when the UN does this partition plan, which is the Resolution 181, it's the second picture here, they're like, the green is going to be Palestinian state, where I was talking about the 45%, and then the white is going to be Jewish land, and it was kind of based on where the settlements already were. As you can see, it sort of fits that, which was going to be like the 53%. Jerusalem is kind of at the bottom tip of that one green dip, and it was going to be neither, right? It was going to be some international regime. I don't really know exactly what that means, but maybe some of you do. After that, 1949 to 1967, this is after the Independence War, and you can see they've gained extra territory. They gained up near Syria and Lebanon, and now that all that's left to be occupied by Palestinian is the Gaza Strip as well as the West Bank. Also Golan Heights, but for some reason this doesn't show that on this map, but that's okay. In 2000, you can see the difference when we get to 2000 is just the fact that bad conditions in Israel have caused Arabs to be, well, to leave, basically, as well as the deportations that I talk about. So they're just, that one just shows that they're just way less Arab people now than there were after the wars. So if you want to go to the next picture. Okay, so So that's Israel as Israel sees itself. I don't know if you guys know this, but the maps look different, whether it's the UN making the map, the US making the map, Israel making the map. That's the map that Israel would make. They own all of it, right? They do, like, make a line there. That's called the green line, which I'm going to talk about in a second. And they just differentiate. They just say that the stuff in the middle is called Israel proper. That's what everyone in Israel says, which I think has a meaning of its own, as you can imagine. And then the stuff within the line up there, up at the very top, which is Golan Heights and Gaza Strip down there, they will consider Israel as well, although that is the territory that the UN will call Palestinian occupied territory. So I'm going to mention that right now. I'll just skip to the 6 day. 1948 to 1952 is a huge mass immigration, as you can imagine. Now they've said, this is the state of Israel, this is the Jewish homeland. So many Jews from throughout the world are quickly moving to Israel. And then in 1967 is the 6 day war. That's really, really, really important to the conflict in Israel right now, because in the 6 day war, basically, the Arab nation started massing troops right at the border, right down here at the Egypt-Israel border. Egypt started massing troops. They also knew that Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon were on Egypt's side, so they assumed that meant that all of the countries were getting ready to once again attack Israel. So Egypt's putting troops on near the border, making a statement, we're going to come and attack you. So Israel decides to do a sneak attack, which they call preemptive self-defense. It sounds a little bit like an oxymoron. Huge conflict in the international community in Israel, that statement alone, preemptive self-defense. We had a lot of classes on that. It's really bizarre. But they, in self-defense, supposedly, preemptive self-defense, they attacked the Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan air forces and destroyed all of their planes on the ground, so they no longer had air forces. And in a shocking, like shocking result, they again won this war. So they won the 6 day war, which Israel itself did not think they had any chance of winning. And they actually ended up gaining another like 45% of the territory. And UN was really mad at them for this. The UN now says that countries are not allowed to legally gain possession of territory by force. And that's exactly what Israel had done. And so the UN basically said, this is in their Resolution 242, they just said, Israel, you have to give it all back. That was their resolution. And Israel basically said no. They're like, no way, I'm not going to do that. So yeah, so that's left it with the complicated situation that there is now, where the UN, actually, if you want to go to the next map. So this is how parts of the world would view Israel, right? This is a different map. And you can see those parts are taken out because the West Bank is viewed as part of Jordan, Gaza Strip is viewed as part of Egypt, and Golan Heights at the top right is part of Syria or Lebanon, depending on what you believe for some reason. If you want to go to the next map, This is how the UN views Israel. It's different again. Israel's the middle part, and those three spots that I just mentioned, Golan Heights, West Bank, and Gaza, they believe that is no man's land. Nobody owns that. They call it Palestinian occupied territory, but they don't view Palestine as a country of its own. So it's very complicated, because even the maps aren't the same, depending on who made the map. So I will also say that the 6 day war, as I'm saying, it's very important to Israel and the conflict there. One of the reasons is the ultra-Orthodox Jews, which are the really conservative fundamentalist Jewish people in Israel, they were waiting for the Messiah to come to tell them that Israel was the new promised land. After the 6 day war, the ultra-Orthodox Jews said, because this was so surprising we won the war, this must have been God telling us that this now is our land. So after this war, they became convinced that Israel is God's promised land to the Israelites or the Jewish people and to the Jewish people alone. So you can see how that becomes conflict for all the Arab people living in the area.
Carol,
yes.
What's the relationship between the ultra-Orthodox Jewish belief about those boundaries and the Zionist understanding of
Well, it's hard to separate Zionism from ultra-Orthodox because often a Zionist would also be an ultra-Orthodox and vice versa. But the ultra-Orthodox wouldn't necessarily believe that all the Jews should come back to Israel, whereas the Zionists would say, regardless of whether they're conservative and ultra-Orthodox, they would say that everybody should come back to Israel and that this land is promised to us by God. So also, I'll say that the Zionist movement started way back in 1897, whereas the ultra-Orthodox, a lot of them waited until the Six-Day War to believe that this was the promised land from God. So it's kind of a timing difference. But again, like I said, I think a lot of ultra-Orthodox are Zionists, and a lot of Zionists are ultra-Orthodox, but because it's a movement. Does that make sense? Has everything I said make sense so far? Okay. I like that. Feel free to jump in if I'm making something really confusing, because it is really confusing. I'm going to quickly point out, you see how it's a dotted line around the West Bank, around Gaza, and Golan Heights? I mentioned this before, that's called the Green Line. They talk about this in Israel all the time, and it was really confusing until I figured out what it meant. The Green Line is just based on ceasefire placement during actually the War of Independence. And then later the Six-Day War, so it kind of moved, it kind of didn't. But basically it means like literally the tanks went along this line where they were like facing each other. And then they said ceasefire. And so everyone stopped shooting. And then there was drawn a line. So whoever's on this side was Palestinians, whoever was on this side were Israelis. And literally this line was just like, that's where the tanks are. That's where people are facing each other firing. And so they drew this line. And the really interesting thing is that ceasefire just has never been lifted. It's still there from 1948. So the war sort of technically isn't over, and yet it's been on a ceasefire since 1948. I mean, there's the Six-Day War, which confuses that whole thing, but that's what that green line is based on, so it's really bizarre. But people from Israel are not supposed to go in to go, they call it go in inside, outside the green line. Just to clear that up, inside the green line is Israel proper, outside the green line is where you see kind of the yellow spaces. So it's not really an inside-outside thing technically, but that's how they refer to it. So Israelis are not supposed to go outside the green line, and Palestinians are not supposed to come inside the green line. There's actually literally a wall along most of the places with like cool graffiti all over it and really neat things that they say and stuff, political movements and whatever. It's really cool, but maybe not to people there. Gaza Strip's a whole nother thing. I'm sure you've all heard tons of that in the news, probably a lot more than I have. But actually, the Israeli forces are not in Gaza Strip anymore, so they don't actually consider that an area of conflict anymore. Golan Heights is still an area of conflict because the UN is still saying that Israel's supposed to pull out because they took that by force from Syria in 1967. Okay. So, really quickly, I kind of went over this, but the remaining conflicts today, this was historical. Today, the problems are still Golan Heights, West Bank, and Jerusalem, which I didn't actually mention Jerusalem, which is the most bizarre of all of the Green Line issues. So Golan Heights was taken in 1967, again, in a, supposedly an act of preemptive self-defense. They took it from Syria, and international community says Golan Heights is not a part of Israel because you can't take it by force. Same with the West Bank. The West Bank was actually taken by Jordan in 1948 and then taken back by Israel in 1967. The UN doesn't recognize either of those. That's why they call the West Bank no man's land, because both groups took it by force, so neither of them can be recognized legally. So it's nobody's. It's just Palestinian-occupied territory, meaning there are Palestinians there. That's all they say about it. Jerusalem, if you want to go to that map or PDF, is really interesting. Jerusalem was actually, the Green Line went straight through the middle of Jerusalem. The fighting was in East and West Jerusalem. There's the Green Line. You can see how it's really confusing to anyone who lives there because it like bounces all around and does weird circles and things. Then there's this part right up here, if you can see my shadow. This is inside the Green Line and this is inside the Green Line, but you have to go through Palestinian-occupied territory to get there. And by the way,
I lived right there in the university.
So I would, so if you believe that there is Palestine and Israel, then every day to go out for lunch, we went from Israel through Palestine to Israel. So that was really interesting. But anyway, so this is East Jerusalem, this is West Jerusalem. They were divided by the green line, and this is because Israel took all of Jerusalem in... No, sorry, they took West Jerusalem in 1948, then they took East Jerusalem in 1967. Because the UN says they have to give back everything they took in 1967, but not what they took in 1948, the UN says that half of Jerusalem is Palestinian-occupied territory, and the other half is Israel. So that's really complicated for anyone who lives in this city. What's even more interesting, if you actually go there, this is all Arab people, this is all Jewish people. So they actually did that somehow. I don't know, it's really bizarre. This is the old city right here. If anyone saw my picture on Facebook, that's the really old-looking buildings and the Church of the Sepulchre and, you know, Via Della Rosa and all that kind of stuff. That's all Arab land. It's full of Arab people, no Jewish people in there, and they'd be really offended if you confuse them with a Jewish person. This place is really tense. It is the most tense place I've ever been in my life. I got yelled at and chased a few times. So it's really easy to make people upset. Really easy. And if you ask me about that sometime, because that's a really funny multiple stories of getting chased and yelled at. It's really scary. Okay, what was I going to say about this? Yeah. I got something mixed up or lost a page that sounds like me. One second. I'll make it up if I don't find it. Okay, then I'm gonna make it up. What I was gonna say basically is I was gonna talk about why is this important in Canada. I already mentioned that conflicts here are conflicts everywhere else in the world. That's hard to imagine because this seems really complicated, and maybe it is more complicated than problems we might think we have in Canada. But one of the big issues and themes you can see, I would say, is fundamentalism. When I say fundamentalism, I'll say what I mean by that is I'm right and you're wrong thinking. You see that's a major theme, and not just Islamic Jewish fundamentalism, but also Christian fundamentalism, right? I mean, you talk about the Christian crusaders coming in and saying whoever's not a Christian should just be massacred. I don't really understand how you get to that in your head, but that's what happened. So there's a lot of fundamentalism that shaped this place in the world and left it in a state of huge conflict and tension on a daily basis. I also want to say, while I was there, I had the opportunity to be there for the celebration of Jerusalem Day, which is the most troubling thing I've ever seen, probably in my entire life, and probably the thing that's made me most angry of any political issue. I didn't plan to say this, but I'm going to anyway because I don't have notes. So, Jerusalem Day is the day that the Jewish people celebrate taking over all of Jerusalem in the Six-Day War. And how they celebrate is that they get a parade of people together and they march through the Arab communities yelling racist comments at the Arabs. That's, like I'm talking like that happened 3 weeks ago. Not like... And then the Arab people throw rocks at the Jewish people, which I think makes sense. So... It's really upsetting, really, really upsetting, and it is makes so much sense, actually, in fundamentalist line of thinking, this that we're absolutely right, you're absolutely wrong, we're good, you're bad, enemy thinking, and like I said, that's the thought that paints all of Israel and the history of Israel, but obviously fundamentalist thought is pervasive throughout the world, and I think that we'd all be kidding ourselves if we said that not every single one of us hasn't had a time where we thought we're right and everyone else is wrong. So kind of improving this, but that's how I felt. That was my big takeaway. When I left Israel, I was like, everybody here thinks that they're right and everyone else is wrong. And the things that they're doing in the name of being right, in the name of God's promised people, promised land. Because I will also say, I didn't get into like really the Muslim history, but the Muslims in the area also believe that God specifically promised that land to them and them alone. So you can imagine what a conflict it is when the Muslims are like, we're here because God promised this land to us and us alone. And the Jews are like, we're here because God promised this land to us and us alone. So that's very problematic thinking. And the fact that they could never believe that they could be wrong or that anyone else could be right or there could be any other truth out there causes them to do great atrocities in the name of that belief. We had a speaker who came and spoke to us. He was in charge of, he gives the last word on targeted killing for the Israeli Defense Forces. So basically what happens is when the Israeli Defense Forces decide we want to kill this person because we heard they have this or they have some kind of weapon or they're going to do something bad, they call him, whether it's 3 a.m, whatever, they call him and they say, hey, we have this guy, he's wearing a blue shirt. We were told there'd be a guy with a blue shirt that's going to be carrying a bomb. We found this guy with a blue shirt and he's carrying something. Can we kill him? And the guy gets to say yes or no. This is one of the speakers we had. So really cool opportunity to hear from him. But really troubling at the same time. He actually was pretty great and really reasonable person, but it's still crazy to hear about that you'd even need someone to have that job. And he talked about things like all sorts of preemptive self-defense tactics of the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces. And one of the things they had to deal with was human shielding. Apparently, Palestinians in Gaza Strip were grabbing children and blocking bullets with them. So this is another huge atrocity. That being said, apparently the IDF has done this before as well. Just going to say that. This is how the conflict tends to go. Every atrocity done by one side, there's another atrocity done by the other. There is really no good, bad guy situation here. It's like just bad things happening all the time. So, it's really bad. And it was really hard to hear. And it's really mystifying to hear that this is all based on, you know, fundamentalist, I'm right and you're wrong thinking. This is all comes from like a perspective or a belief in God that's a certain way that would lead you to these kinds of atrocities. So it's really sad. And like I said, this is going to be a series. So today what I wanted to do was to start by bringing up something Brian McLaren actually talks about in a podcast. It's called Preemptive Peacemaking. I don't know if you've heard it. It's really, really interesting. And he actually talks about Israel specifically, the Holocaust, a number of conflicts going on in the world today. And so I think it's interesting with preemptive self-defense, preemptive peacemaking. You can see the differences there. But he talks about 6 narratives surrounding conflict in the world today. And I actually think they're a really helpful framework for looking at the world and how conflict happens and alternatives to conflict. Today, obviously, I've already taken up tons of your time, and I'm just going to take up a little bit more by just mentioning one of them. Then I'm going to go on next time I speak to talk about a few more of those narratives, 5 more exactly of those narratives. So today, I just want to bring up victimization narrative. This is one of the narratives that McLaren talks about in his podcast. And he says victimization narrative applies to people that have been hurt by a previous purification narrative. So that's one of the other 5 narratives. I'm not going to get into it, but it basically refers to when people are victimized from scapegoating, from abuses, from genocide, like the Jews experienced, or attempted genocide, that is, that the Jews experienced in the Holocaust. So when people are victimized, he talked about how victimization can be beneficial to a group, actually, in some ways. It can give a deep social identity to a group of people as survivors. They can see themselves as survivors, and there can be a survivorship pride surrounding getting out of whatever terrible thing they experienced. It can unite the group, and it can actually help aid survival in the long run. He also talks about the beneficial ways that the group or individuals can become compassionate to others who experience this kind of thing. They can be sympathetic to other people's situations. He actually gives the example of how the Jewish people in the U.S., the synagogues were actually one of the top groups of people that tried to help out with the situation in Darfur. And he said that they explained that they wanted to prevent what happened to them from happening to anyone else in the world. So you can see how it's really beneficial for a group to survive through victimization and then in turn try to prevent that from happening to anyone else in the world. But, this is the big but, on the other hand, there's a huge tendency in the world for victimized groups to lead into a revolution story. This is what we see happening with the Jewish people when they get their own state in Israel. And with the revolution story, the victims are gaining power and they actually can end up playing the aggressor themselves. He points to this happening in Gaza Strip, where the Israelis, who were previously severely victimized in the Holocaust, now have power over their own territory and are deporting Palestinians from Gaza Strip, as well as blocking off sea passage so that food can't be brought in and people are starving to death in the Gaza Strip. So he talks about how there you see victims becoming aggressors because they've actually, as a group, their identity has been formed in this kind of framework of victim-aggressor, and now that they've become on top, they're still within that framework of victim-aggressor, like the framework of domination. So that's not a great result. I just want to say, I don't want to give the impression that the situation in Gaza Strip was really simple. Obviously, like everything in Israel is really complicated. There was not a bad guy and a good guy. It wasn't like Israel was the bad guy and everyone in Gaza Strip was the good guy. There's lots of bad things happening on both sides. In some ways, you can understand why Sea Passage was being blocked off because they were actually worried about, you know, terrorists coming in, all sorts of other things. And so there was preventative measures, but at the same time, you can see that obviously human rights are not being respected, and there is an irony there coming from a group that their human rights were completely removed and taken away from them, and now they're removing human rights from another group of people in a different time. So there is definitely irony there. I will also say that it's more complicated than bad guy, good guy, because religion's at play, and religion always makes things more complicated. Zionism, as I talked about before, that gives Jews the belief that, some Jews, I should say, Zionism is a very specific movement. It's not all Jewish people. In fact, none of the things I've said are all Jewish people, obviously, or even the majority necessarily. But Zionism leads a group of people to believe that the land is promised to the Jews and Jews alone. So through that framework, you can also understand what's happening in the Gaza Strip as well as the West Bank. It's really complicated. So from here, the next thing, like I said, I'd like to talk about the other five narratives the next time that I speak, that McLaren sets out in his podcast. And specifically, I want to focus on one of the narratives, which is the gospel narrative, which McLaren believes has the power to transform our world and us as individuals. So that's actually a really hopeful story. So hopefully next time I speak, it'll be more hopeful than this. McLaren also points out that sadly, for some reason, a lot of Christians don't necessarily connect the gospel story with peace and healing for the world in real time today. Sometimes there's just a vision of like one day God will come down and fix it all and we don't have to be involved in that. So McLaren takes a different view than that perspective, and he looks more at how Christians can be involved in peacemaking, preemptive peacemaking here today in real time. So that's really interesting, really hopeful, and that's what we're going to get into. And we're going to attempt to do that without falling into a new form of fundamentalism. I don't know if that's really possible, but I'd like to avoid us going into a perspective of the gospel story that says, oh, now we are right and everyone else is wrong. I don't know if you can ever avoid that, but it seems like it's all too comfortable to end up there and get back into that cycle over and over again. So we're going to attempt to do all this without going there. I don't know if that's possible. And hopefully end up in a place of hope. So on that very unsettled but hopeful note, the worship team can come back up. And you can take it from there.